we started out in this study for this particular quarter looking at Genesis and Exodus. We went back and went through in a very survey kind of a fashion through Genesis, pointed out the beginnings of things as they were presented, come down to about the 12th chapter, and we get a hold of Abraham as the one who we're following from that point forward. Through him, there would be a blessing that was brought upon all nations. The fact was that man sinned and fell from God. And as a result of that, there needed to be a sacrifice given. There needed to be a way for man to be brought back to God. From Genesis 3 onward, that's the story that's being told. Chapter 12 of Genesis pointing out Abraham being called by God because of his faith. As a result of that, he's going to be the one who is going to have this great nation, have many of his descendants, and through his seed all nations of the earth would be blessed. You follow Abraham through the time of Genesis, come to the book of Exodus, and now the people who are his generations after him, those who are the people of his grandson Israel, they are in captivity in Egypt as a result of going there first and blessed as a result of their connection together with Joseph. They're now cursed and they're now slaves. And as a result of that, God sends Moses to deliver them from that slavery. They do. They go out from that slavery as a result of God's power being shown to Abraham or being shown to Pharaoh. Pharaoh each time refuses to send the people of God forward as he has told them to do, and as a result he suffers more and more until finally that last plague of the death of the firstborn comes upon them. When that takes place, they leave Egypt, they go out into the wilderness, and as they're in the wilderness, they go towards Mount Sinai, and at Mount Sinai, you have then a giving of the law. And that's where we are right now as we look at this. In looking at the things of our study so far, let's always keep in mind the fact that as we look at that outline, we see first Israel in Egypt. Then you have the plagues that are taking place. There's the Exodus from Egypt that goes to Mount Sinai. And number three then, starting in chapter 19, you have the last main division of this until you come to a conclusion. And that is that Israel is at Sinai. Sinai, they're given the law. As a result of that law being summed up in Exodus chapter 20, you notice the fact that there are 10 commandments that are given. Thanks, Aaron. I was wondering who would give me there. As a result of having the law been having the law given, then there are ones who then have a responsibility to start doing these things that the law says. One of those, and a great part of the book of Exodus, is about the tabernacle and the building of the tabernacle. We've been through most of it with regard to the specifications, but what we're looking at tonight is in chapter 28 through chapter 30, and that is when we note the priestly garments, the design of the breastplate of judgment, the sacred vestments, the things that are given together with that breastplate and the ephod. Description of all of the consecration brought upon Aaron and his sons. The sacrifices for that consecration. The design of the altar of incense. The atonement money and what it is to be, or how it is to be gained, and what it is to be used for as well. The design of the brass laver to wash outside the tent of the tabernacle. And then the anointing, the oil, and the incense are looked at as to how they are to be made and used. When you come to the next section that's here, it has to do with the idea of what takes place between the specifications and the building of it. But when you come over to the building of the tabernacle, starting in chapter 35, You take it down through the end of chapter 39, and we're going to look at the last two parts of that. The making of the priestly garments in the first part of chapter 39, and then the work of finishing the tabernacle in the last part of chapter 39. Then we'll have that last little part of this being done, the making of that tabernacle and it being put to use in the assembly of the tabernacle, how it's all brought together and God's pleasure with that. Anybody got anything there? Anything on the outline that we need to go back on, somebody didn't understand or whatever? All right. Now we're ready to go. Last time we talked about the tabernacle and how it was an explore plan. In one sense, you call this the tabernacle, just this building that had the most holy place and the holy place. But how else is that term tabernacle used? It's for the whole of it, right? Sometimes you're talking about the tabernacle site or the things done in the tabernacle. Of course, the courtyard of the tabernacle, some of what we had talked about last time, talked about the courtyard of the tabernacle. That was part of the tabernacle. But it was outside of that building. And outside of that building, you have the labor of washing of the hands and feet of the high priest and the priest, and the altar of burnt offering, where there were those offerings given unto God. When you look at the tabernacle, as it was summed up last time, what did God say about it? How was it done? When you look at the finished product, as the plans were given and then they built that, what did God say about it? How is it done? Well or not so well? All right. It was done in a way that pleased Him. It was done well because they followed the pattern in all things that were there. Now, what we're going to turn our attention to this evening is to notice the priestly garments that are here. You're going to see as we go through these several different kind of looks. Nobody had out their Polaroid that day when the high priest came out, so we didn't get any pictures, sad to say. You notice, though, that they're trying to stay within the relative idea of how it's done. There's a lot of different pictures of that in my mind. In mine, they aren't any of these. I've kind of got another thing pictured a little bit myself with more of the gold that's in and out of the lacings than what any of these show. But whatever the case, they're trying to represent what was there. The priestly garments were made up of what? What was there for those priestly garments?
The breastplate, the ephod.
No, not the particular things, the parts of the garments. What was the base material? Do what?
Fine linen.
Okay, there was a fine linen. There's a fabric of blue, right? Fabric of scarlet. Somebody said it.
A
purple, okay. What else?
Gold.
And so those are going to be the things that you're going to see predominantly through here that are brought out. And as you look at those base, I guess you would say, materials they had to start with, that's what you need to notice is put into place with all of these. They're brought together in a different way, but that's the base material that's going to be brought out. All right, here's one with this kind of a apron or the ephod that's talked about of the garments of the high priest. These were the parts of it. There's a turban. That's the hat, right? What else is it called? Okay, a cap. Some others of you have another word. Mitre, if you're using the King James or American Standard, and some of those others, they use that word mitre that's there. The crown is simply that which is a part of that turban. That's not really a separate piece of clothing. The ephod that you have, the breastplate, the belt, which is called what?
The sash.
Okay, the sash or the girdle that is there, the robe, the tunic, and then the pants, or how's that also? When breeches, okay, that you have the tunic and those breeches made out of the same thing, really, they're looked at as companions, sort of a fashion. This is another one. We're taking Exodus chapter 28. If you want to go back and use these charts to try to set up each one of them and see what is done in this, I put it here so that you can get these verses from all of them on the turban and all that has to do with that. The shoulder pieces with the names of the tribes of Israel. Then you have the Urim and the Thummim. That's not pictured. It's within that ephod or behind the breastplate, if you will. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. That sash or girdle, the belt that was there. The ephod, which is present of this garment here that you're talking about, that had a is kind of one together to which they just slipped over the head in that sort of way. The breastplate of judgment that was used, why is it called the breastplate of judgment? Why the breastplate of judgment? What did that have to do with any judgment? Okay, because there are the Thummim, or that which were within that breastplate, or behind the breastplate, and beside the high priest himself, in that inner pocket. And with that, God helped him to make decisions about what had to be done. That was his aid in that fashion that God had promised to give to the high priest on down through the year. He had 12 stones representing what? 12 tribes of Israel. And then you have the undergarments, as this points out. This is true with regard to the linen breeches and also this linen that you have, an undergarment, a linen tunic piece, if you will, that he was also to wear. Now, in the next one, let's look at the ephod itself. What was the ephod for? What was the point of its purpose? Do you remember in Old Testament history anybody else wearing an ephod? An ephod was worn by David as he came back from battle. And Michal said that he had taken that off and was dancing among the people in celebration for their victory like one of the vain fellows would do. Well, why did she say that? Because the ephod of the king was a garment that showed he was the king. The king wasn't to take off the kingly garment because that would be a degradation to his office. He was always a king unto God, and therefore he was to wear the symbol of that. The high priest had an ephod, meaning what? He had a responsibility that was given to him, and this was the piece of clothing that showed that. Nobody else wore an ephod that had a breastplate attached with 12 stones. Nobody else did that. That was identifying him as to who he was as the high priest. Nobody needed to wonder, who is it? You could see it very clearly by what he did. All right. Now, the robe of the ephod, that blue thing that's underneath, is one of the things statements about the priestly garments will call this a coat that's given. In fact, that's the name most often given, and a robe. Sometimes some of the newer translations translate it as that which is a tunic. And that gets problematic. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But I don't think a tunic is the right term for that. I'd rather have that talked about as to what's underneath if you're going to look at things the way that it ought to be. All right, you have your ephod here. You have this robe that's there. And then a sash or a girdle that is made. What was the purpose of that? I'm not trying to trick you. This is some religious purpose. I mean, what's obviously the purpose of a belt? All right, you're getting everything together and holding in a very practical sense. That's the point. It sashes that together. You had a front piece and a back piece of an ephod that if you didn't have a sash or something there, you were going to have problems for very long because it was going to go flying everywhere. So here's what you have, this bringing of it together. What does a girdle also always represent in the scripture as we see it? Gird up, Peter says, the loins of your mind. Okay. What's that? What's that suggesting? What happened in the clothing of people of Bible times that we need to know about to understand what that would mean? Gird up the loins of your mind. Somebody was going to go out and work.
Get ready.
All right. They get ready. And how do they get ready? They have this long flowing robe that's on. Is that going to be the best thing to make sure all of it stays together and you're able to work real easily? So what did they do? All right, they girded that up. And the result was all of their loins and everything that were to be used in that work, in the straining of the stomach muscles, everything else, the back, whatever, it was all cinched together in that sort of way. And so they had this ability to take that outer garment and bring that all together. When Peter talks about it in 1 Peter chapter 1, gird up the loins of your mind, what's his point? It's a figurative use of the word loins, the loins of your mind. In other words, this is what you're going to use to live right in your mind. Now, before you start living as a child of God, what do you need to do? You need to get your mind right. You need to get it ready. And that's the point here. With regard to the high priest, he had to have something to gird up or something that was there that would be a girdle to put things together in that way. And then we have this, the shoulder piece. I didn't know whether to put this on this one or the next one with the breastplate ribbon. But this is going on the shoulders. You have a binding together of that which is the front and the back and everything else by a putting of these statements of the shoulder pieces. And what were they to do? What was the purpose of that? I've lost my place. Just a second. All right.
Remembrance of the sons of Israel.
Okay, yeah. You have the remembrance of the sons of Israel that are there as well. So this takes place in three different places. They're reminded with the stones on the shoulder, with the breastplate and the stones that are there, and now these shoulder pieces as well, that they're to remember they're all together in that. Why do you think that a Levite had to be reminded of that so many times? When you're given a place of importance, may it tempt you to feel like you're above everybody else? Know anybody that happened with? Paul said, because of the great visions and revelation given to him, there was given a thorn in the flesh that he asked that it might be removed, and he was told that his grace was sufficient. God's grace was sufficient to him. That because of the vision, he needed to understand he was not the great one. God was. Now, that's something that you see repeatedly in Scripture. Now, tell me about that, but it would go in, along with the same kind of a thing. That his mind is called back. You're a servant of all of Israel. You're not a servant of yourself, for sure. You're not one who's just taking care of your people in Levi. You have a responsibility and care for the whole of God's people and for what he's given you to do. Now, anybody on that? That's part of that. The breastplate, that breastplate that's there of judgment as it is called. That breastplate of judgment, because of the pocket behind, you would have the Urim and the Thummim that were used. But that breastplate itself had a memory that was there in there being those rows of stones. Each of those stones, what was it recalling? The tribe that was there of that given name. And you'll notice that it's not just a bunch of stones that are, shall we say, so-so in value. These are stones that would have been of the highest of value during the time that you have, that this is going on. You didn't mine a great deal of stones from well inside the earth until a much later date in history. These are ones, therefore, that had even greater worth. Gold tended to be found coming in outcroppings and could be easily gotten to in many ways. But that wasn't so with many of these stones that are very precious. They are ones that have been, by deep mining, as a result of not having many, they would have been extremely expensive and all that was there. Anybody else there? That's part of it that you got is the mitre and crown. That which is the turban or mitre, and then the crown, the gold that was there about that. What was that? What did it have a sign of across his forehead? Okay. Holiness of the Lord, or literally the interpretation would be holy to Jehovah. In other words, this one that is doing this, the high priest, it's not about him. He is to be put holy or consecrated, separated. You remember the word holy and the word sanctified in the same word. And so he talks about that idea of holy or sanctified unto Jehovah. That's who he's serving in all of this place. And it's to be a constant reminder to him of that very thing. When you look at the high priest and what he wore, and the regular priest and what he wore, what do you notice about a difference from the picture or from your reading? Were there things that the regular priest wore that the high priest did not wear? No. It's the other way around, didn't it? There were things that the high priest wore that the regular priest did not wear. In other words, he's wearing that fine linen tunic that's there. That is that base clothing that would be present. And then the linen breeches that were pointed out as well. Both of those were the tunic and then the linen breeches were worn both by the regular priest and the high priest. It's just that that regular priest did not wear all the other stuff that's there. That separated out one man, that man being the high priest. They weren't given all of the things that he was given to wear. Anything else there? Now let me ask a question with regard to this tunic. When you get the word tunic that is used there, or sometimes you will see that rendered as that which is a, a coat, I'd rather use the word coat of the next outer garment that is there. But a tunic was a typical garment of everybody, the base garment of everyone who would have been around at that time. That was just the standard base clothing. Typically, it had sleeves. It ran from the shoulders to the knees or below, and this one it specified to be below the knee in that way. What was its purpose? It was seen as a cover so that no one, when they looked upon that person, would look upon his nakedness. That's the statement that's made all the way from when you go back to Genesis chapter 3. That there was a covering of God with a tunic, a katunit, as it said in the original language. And that is what would cover at least shoulders down to the knees, down to the calves or so. Now, with this, there was an addition. It said there's also linen breeches. And they would reach from, look at what it says there in Exodus chapter 28, verse 42 and 43. From the loins even unto the thighs. Now, did that mean, well, the loins started here and the thighs started there, so there's just this little strip that was kind of in between that area? No. That's a typical construction of what you see in Hebrew. It's called the menad construction. It talks about things the same way we would from Texas. If you were going to go through Texas east to west, it would go from Orange to El Paso. Now, which one of those is not in Texas? Both of them. In other words, it's inclusive. This part is in it, and this part is in it. And that's the construction that's given here, a menad construction. From the loins, menad, all the way down through thighs. In other words, all of that is covered. That was to be done in order to hide their nakedness, it says, before the Lord. Now, I want you to think about something. If the tunic covered from the shoulders down to at least the calves, which it did because that's what it says, then how are you as an individual going to ever see those linen breeches? One of the reasons that the law said you don't make steps to the altar. You don't make those steps because they'd go up and someone could see in that underneath kind of a way. You weren't to have that on the altars of Israel. So how would they know there was nakedness that needed to be covered? I think the key to that is the statement before the Lord. You remember when we talked about last time that the time when they would come to worship at the tabernacle, there would be the incense that was burning. And here it was that God said he would meet the representative of them, the high priest, or the one that he called to the door of the tent of meeting, and he would speak with them. But the time when he went into the figurative presence of the Lord is only once a year. When was that? Day of Atonement. There was always that incense that was clouding them. As a priest, as the high priest went in, that smoke of the glory of the Lord, as it says it was, would be where? Everywhere. Permeating the whole of that tent. And so the point is, God says, I don't want you to show that before me. And God is on my threat. And the sense of that is, you keep that from showing even in that case. And so these linen breeches were made for that purpose. Otherwise, there wouldn't have been anybody that could have seen them in that sort of a way. it clearly is a statement to the modesty of that priest, to the fact that he is to be covered in such a way that he is seen as holy to the Lord, not having any of the sense of unholiness about him. All right, anybody got anything there? Go ahead.
Was there anything common about breeches among normal people? I mean, were they used by the people of the day, like those that were workers or laborers? Or
sometimes. It tended to be someone who was a little bit more affluent in that way, and it tended to be something that was done more in what you would see of Israel and the things we know of than it was in the nations round about. Anything else? Let me get on that for a minute. If you go back and you look at some of these reliefs that are up on the Jews, given of when they went into Assyrian captivity and then when they went into Babylonian captivity, it pictures the Jews wearing the clothes that they wore at the time. And we don't have to guess about what those clothes were like. They're really pretty well documented. Same thing you'd say, well, what did Greeks wear? Well, you've got enough statues that are out there. Not all of them are sans any clothing. Many of them have exactly what they wore in the time, and certainly that was seen in that kind of release as well. All right. Anybody else?
It would be pretty heavy too by the time they got everything put together.
Yeah.
So trying to walk up some stairs, if it was that way, it would be quite labor.
Now that would be a problem, but the other is the reason that's given in the text. That their nakedness be not seen of the Lord. All right. Now, when we get to the 39th chapter, what do we have? All of these things are made. The priestly garments are made. And now you come to the last part of that in verse 32 to 43. Would somebody read that, please?
Thus all the work of the tabernacle of the tent of meeting was finished. And the children of Israel did according to all that the Lord had commanded Moses, so they did. And they brought the tabernacle to Moses, the tent and all its furnishings, its clasps, its boards, its bars, its pillars, and its sockets, the covering of ram skins dyed red, the covering of badger skins, and the veil of the covering, the ark of the testimony with its poles and the mercy seat, the table and its utensils, and the showbread, the pure gold lampstand with its lamps, the lamp set in order, all its utensils, and the oil for light, the gold altar, the anointing oil, and the sweet incense, the screen for the tabernacle door, the bronze altar, its grate of bronze, its poles and all its utensils, the laver with its base, the hangings of the court, its pillars and its sockets, the screen for the court gate, its cords and its pegs, all the utensils for the service of the tabernacle, for the tent of meeting, and the garments of ministry, to minister in the holy place, the holy garments for Aaron the priest, and his son's garments, to minister as priests. According to all that the Lord had commanded Moses, so the children of Israel did all the work. Then Moses looked over all the work, and indeed they had done it. And as the Lord had commanded, just so they had done it. And Moses blessed them.
Okay. Let's go back here. What we have is the last two lessons summed up here in the last paragraph. Where does it talk about the furniture and the making of the tabernacle itself? Starts in verse 32, goes through what? Or you see that ending. All right, 40. There you end that then. And the garments of ministry, the minister of the holy places, is taken up in verse 41. What does it say about that? That was also made just as God commanded it. They did all the work. Same thing said with the physical tabernacle and its furnishings. now with the garments of the of Moses. Then Moses, overall, verse 43, looks at what the Lord had commanded him, and what did he find out? What did he see? They've done it. How did he see that? It's not stated, but it's necessarily implied. When they brought it to him, what did he do? Okay, he checked it against the pattern. That's the point. He can't possibly know this is done in all things just as it was required unless there's a checking of all things according to the pattern. Now, how much would have been sufficient? 95%?
All that was within the pattern.
Okay. If you have anything out of the pattern, it doesn't belong in there. It needs to be redone. So, when you look at that, he says everything there was done according to the pattern. That's a passage sometimes we don't have time, I'm afraid, sometimes in our lessons on authority to go into everything that makes the point. But when somebody says to me, well, that's just a made-up church of Christ doctrine on authority, and you have to have authority for all things, you know what they're telling me is they don't know their Bible. Because you can go back from Old Testament and look at Noah and the Ark. You can look here at the tabernacle. You can look at the temple. When it's done, you can look at the various things of what the prophets did. And what you'll notice with every time, if God gives a commandment, this is how it's done, that's what he means. And he doesn't mean half of it is done that way, or most of it, or almost all of it. He means every single bit. And that's the concept of authority. It is to follow all. Let me ask you something. If it was okay, if I could get you to believe that's okay for one thing, let's say I look at some of that and it says about incense. And some of that stuff may be a little bit hard to come by. You know, right now we couldn't come along and find out all that.
Forget it.
We couldn't find all that frankincense right now to make up incense. So let's just leave that out of there. Is that okay? What if you said, yeah, that's okay. It was a hard time finding it. We couldn't do it this time. We tried the best we could, but we couldn't find any of it. And so we just had to do without it. If that's okay, why couldn't you leave out a second part of that incense? Why just one? Or if it was okay with the incense, why couldn't you do it with the altar of incense? With just one thing being messed up. You could do it with the altar of incense. Why couldn't you do it with the altar of burnt offerings? Or the Ark of the Covenant? You see the point? I heard a statement a long time ago, you can't be a little bit pregnant. You either are or you not. And you can't be a little bit going to authority. You either give yourself to authority by following what's said, all of it, or you don't. It's not a partial thing. It has to be a complete, and that's the whole concept of authority as it's done. Some things are like that. It's either yes or no. And when you look at authority, either you've got a yes that God is the one who gives us authority and we must follow all of that, or no, and if it's a no, you don't have to follow any of it. One or the other of those has to be true. Because neither one, or none of any other combination would work at all. Go ahead.
I think that really sums up in Romans chapter 12, right, verses 1 and 2, where it says, therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, fully pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Verse 2, do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able
Anybody else got anything? Go ahead, Larry.
I'd just like to kind of add to what you said. This is so detailed, and for them to do this, was a lot of was hard work, and to get it done. And conversely, we need ourselves. It makes sense that we need to dig through the New Testament and make sure we did everything according to the pattern too, because these people went to the extreme just to do one thing, the tabernacle, and likewise we to build the church. We have to do with the same vigor that they did to make sure we do it right.
All right, next class, Lord willing, on Sunday, if you'll look at questions, we didn't get to them again. Lesson number 21. I want you to notice while you're looking at that, how long did it take for them to do this? This is a very big undertaking. They came to Horeb or Sinai in the third month after they left Egypt. And it says in the first month of the year, in other words, 9 months afterward, then all of this is finished. I don't know exactly the time that's taken in there, but somewhere relatively close to 9 months. That's going to give a lot of suspicion to various writers. Talk about this as that which represents the birth of Christ. 9 months within the womb and all of these kind of things. I don't find anything like that. That's not the point. What it represents is what it says it represents. The nature of what's to be there in service and holiness to the Lord. But let's look at those things, how long it took, how they finished it, and then what the result was. And we'll then take up wherever Chuck leaves off next Wednesday night. Anything else? All right, that's it.